Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. And Happy New Year. Okay, so today we'll be taking Sutta number 76 in the Majjhima. This is called the Sandika Sutta. It's the discourse with a wandering ascetic named Sandika. Okay, so when this discourse begins, the Buddha is living at Kosambi. Even though the Buddha doesn't play a role in the rest of the sutta. Okay, and at the same time, there was a certain wanderer, a wandering ascetic by the name of Sandika, who is living nearby, accompanied by a large assembly of wanderers. Okay, then one evening, the Venerable Ananda addressed a number of the monks and invited them to go to a certain pool to see a cave. Apparently, there was an interesting cave there. And so, together with these monks, the Venerable Ananda set out to go to see this, what's called the Devakata pool. Apparently, the name of the pool means made by the deities or made by some deities. Okay, and then as Ananda and the monks were walking towards this pool, they passed, or they came close to this wanderer, Sandika, who is sitting surrounded by the other wanderers. And the text describes them in a particular way, which is it's something characteristic in the Buddhist text. Whenever the suttas are describing the wanderers sitting together, or very often it describes them as engaged in conversation about topics which are considered very worldly topics. You never see the monks, Buddhist monks, being described in this way, even though from my experience they also indulge in these discussions. But it's always the other group that's engaged in discussing these unsuitable topics. So they're speaking about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries. I know quite a number of monks who like to boast about the number of countries that they visited. Women, heroes, streets, wells, the dead, trifles, the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or not so. Okay, so then the wanderer, Sandika, sees the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance, and when he sees them, then he tells his own assembly to be quiet. And why should they be quiet? He says, "Here comes the recluse Ananda, a disciple of the recluse Gotama," that's the Buddha, "one of the recluse Gotama's disciples staying at Kosambi. These venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined in quiet. They commend quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us. Whenever I read this passage, I always have to smile to myself. Why is that? I don't know. Do we have any Sri Lankans here? No. Okay, they would understand why I'm smiling. Okay, when I was living in Kandy, this a town in Sri Lanka, a fairly large town. It's in the hill country. I think it was about 1974. One morning, very early in the morning, it could be about 4:30, quarter to five, I heard the sound through the public address system, you know, loudspeaker, the sound of the muezzin, that's the Muslim, that the person at the Muslim mosque who's in charge of reciting the call to prayer. Previously, this must have all been done without any amplification, but suddenly high technology is coming to Sri Lanka, and so the mosque now has an amplifying system, and so we get the call to prayer. I don't know Arabic, so it's ba yo 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 yo. Okay, so this is going on for a couple of weeks. Then one day, a couple of weeks later, again it's about 20 to 5, quarter to 5, there comes the call to prayer starts. Then about 30 seconds into the call for prayer, from a somewhat different direction, another loudspeaker starts up. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Then this goes on for a few days. As soon as the Muslim call for prayer starts, about 15, 20, 30 seconds in, Namo Tassa Bhagavato starts. Then a few days later, the Muslim call to prayer starts at one volume level. Yo, 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 di do, di do. Then comes Namo Tassa Bhagavato. Then the volume on the Muslim call to prayer goes up so that it's ayo, yo, yo. And faintly in the background, you could still hear Bhagavato Arahato. Okay, then a few days later, the Muslim call to prayer starts. Yo, 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 yo. Then comes Namo Tassa Bhagavato. Then the Muslim call to prayer increases. Da, ya, ya, ya. But now, Sama Sambuddhassa. But after some time, they seem to have reached a settlement, especially now, you see, at that time, there seems to have been one mosque with the amplifier amplifying the call to prayer, and then one Buddhist temple came in. But after several weeks, it seems the other Buddhist temple in the area, they couldn't remain without their loudspeaker. So they had to purchase a loudspeaker. And now we had several uncoordinated calls to the Buddhist three refuges, Namo Tassa Bhagavato. Several of the mosques had gotten amplifiers, and it was all becoming a chaos, cacophony?
Cacophony.
Cacophony, thank you. Cacophony of a cacophonous rivalry of calls to prayer, to worship. And so they must have had some kind of religious council meeting, bringing together the representatives of the mosques and the viharas. And so finally they reached some kind of accord so that at a certain time the Muslim call to prayer would take place. It always has to come exactly at the time. I think it's the first flicker of sunlight on the horizon. Just when the horizon starts to turn light, the Muslim prayer to call, the Muslim call to prayer starts. And so they would start at the same time, though their mosques are in different areas. And so where I'm living, I could hear them both, but probably they don't hear each other. But then they reached this, seem to have reached a settlement with the Buddhist temple, so that one Buddhist temple would sound its giving of the three refuges before the Muslim call to prayer starts. I think they would start the first Buddhist call to worship. Maybe it would be about 4:35, 4:40 in the morning. And then the other Buddhist temple would come in about 5:15 so they wouldn't collide with each other. So this is the way it would be during the regular part of the month. But then there's that one day of the month, which is called the Uposatha day, or in singular called the Poya day. This is the full moon day, when all of the Buddhist temples have special ceremonies, special functions. And on that day, it's like an ocean, ocean of calls to worship coming from every, it sounds like every Buddhist temple in the Kandy area is blasting their call to worship through the loudspeaker system. So I hear what might be about five or six Buddhist temples all starting as early as possible in the morning with the Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa, one after another from 4:35 on, and going all day long. And so whenever I hear that, the sentences come into my mind. Those venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined and quiet. They commend quiet. Perhaps if they find our assembly a quiet one, they will think to join us. Okay, so when the assembly of the wanderers becomes quiet, then Venerable Ananda goes to the wanderers, and Sundaka, the chief of the group, he welcomes Venerable Ananda. And then to open a conversation, Venerable Ananda asks Sundaka, what discussion were you engaged in just now when I arrived? And maybe Venerable, Sundaka is too embarrassed to tell the Venerable Ananda that they were speaking about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, and so on. So he says, let be the discussion with which we were engaged just now, but it would be good, Master Ananda, if you would give us a talk on your own teacher's Dhamma. Okay, and so Venerable Ananda agrees to this invitation to speak, and then Venerable Ananda starts to give a teaching of his own, and he uses his own method of treating the teaching. It's not that he's repeating something exactly as the Buddha himself has spoken it, but this way of arranging the teachings of the other groups is quite unique to this sutta. And perhaps it's original to Venerable Ananda. Okay, so Venerable Ananda is going to speak about first he's going to speak about the teachings outside the fold of the Buddha's own teaching. And so the topic are ways of living the spiritual life, what is called in Pali the brahmacharya. And so Ananda says at first that there are four ways that negate the living of the holy life. And in Pali, this is actually expressed more concisely. It might be called four ways that are not the living of the holy life. But I had rendered this four ways that negate the living of the holy life, because as we'll see, the fundamental principles of these four teachings undermine the possibility of living a spiritual life, a meaningful spiritual life. Okay, so first come the four ways that negate the living of the holy life, and then what are called four kinds of holy life that are without consolation. Okay, and so with regard to these four ways of in regard to these eight ways of living the holy life, Ananda says, here a wise person certainly would not live the holy life, or if he should live it in that way, he would not attain the true way, that is the noble world-transcending path, or the Dhamma that is wholesome, the Dhamma that leads, you could say, to the higher development of concentration and wisdom. Okay, so this is Ananda's way of introducing the main topic of his discourse. And now Sundaka asks him to explain first the four ways that negate the living of the holy life. And now Venerable Ananda is going to explain four types of teaching that were current in India during the Buddha's time. And these were four types of teaching that the Buddha himself repeatedly rejected. Sometimes we think that what existed in the Buddha's time before the appearance of the Buddha was predominantly a form of Hinduism. But actually, this is not the case. What existed were two religious or spiritual traditions, two currents of spiritual thought, each coming from different sources. One current is what's commonly called Brahmanism. And this precedes Hinduism as we know it today, or from the Middle Ages onward. What we call Hinduism is a kind of religious form that would have developed perhaps by about the time of the beginning of the Common Era, or even maybe a couple of centuries afterwards. But before that, we have something called Brahmanism, which is the religion as preserved by the Brahmins, and it's based on the Vedas. And it centers upon the performance of sacrifice and the rituals prescribed by the Vedas. And then alongside Brahmanism, there was another religious current, which was, perhaps it has origins going back even before the arrival of the Brahmins in India. The Brahmins originally came from Central Asia into India. But before the Brahmins arrived, or the Aryan people arrived, there were groups, apparently that there were groups of wanderers who could have practiced a type of yoga, types of meditation. And out of that current of pre-Aryan Indian religion, there appeared philosophers during the time of the Buddha who devised their own systems of thought. And this current of spiritual thought is called, sometimes it's called the religion of the Samanas. The Samanas were the ascetics who renounced the household life, rejected the authority of the Vedas, rejected the caste system, the caste system upheld by the Brahmins. And they lived lives of renunciation, spiritual discipline, ascetic practice. And many of them didn't follow any fixed spiritual tradition or fixed spiritual teaching, but they devised their own teaching, sometimes by reasoning, sometimes by on the basis of their meditative experience. Okay, so during the Buddha's time, there were some prominent teachers who belonged to the group of Samanas, and they propounded teachings that the Buddha himself rejected. The Buddha also belonged to the class of Samanas. That's why he's called Samana Gotama, the ascetic Gotama. Okay, so now Venerable Ananda is going to explain four of these teachings that were expounded by the Samanas, the ascetics of the period. And the first is a teaching which it's pretty much equivalent to what we would call materialism. Okay, so here Ananda explains, I'm in paragraph 7. He says, some teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this: there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Okay, what this means, it doesn't mean that if you give a gift that nothing at all has been given, but the point of this statement is that there is no value or merit in giving, no point in practicing giving, no point in making offerings, no point in, you could say, practicing charity. And then the reason is given with the statement, there is no fruit or result of good and bad actions. So this teacher is denying the effectiveness of karma. He's saying that even though we judge actions as good or bad, but they don't produce any kind of karmic result. According to the teaching of karma, good actions produce favorable results. They bring happiness and well-being to the one who performs them, while bad or unwholesome actions produce suffering. They bring pain and insecurity and or harm to the one who performs them. So this teacher is denying that there's anything like karma, any law of karma. He says there's no this world, no other world. Actually, what this means, of course, he's not denying that this world exists, but his point is that there is no rebirth back into this world or no rebirth into any other world. He says there is no father, no mother, no father. It doesn't mean that he's denying that people are born from parents, but the point of this statement is that there's no obligation, sort of no children are not on any, under any moral obligation to look after their mother and father. This is a very important principle in Indian society or Indian culture, just like in Chinese culture. The child has the duty to look after the parents, to take care of the parents. But this teacher is saying, don't bother to look at them, go out, have a good time, let the old folks wither and pass away. You shouldn't lose your chance to enjoy life, taking care of your parents. Okay, then no beings who are reborn spontaneously. And I'm not sure if that is actually the intended meaning of this statement, because it could also be understood. It occurred to me that this could also be understood simply to be saying that there are no beings who are reborn. In other words, that there is no rebirth at all. And then he's saying there are no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized the nature of this world by direct knowledge and explain them to others. Okay, then he goes on to, now he's giving the reason why he makes this assertion. He says, a person consists of the four great elements. That, you know, that's it. A person is really just a physical body made up of the four elements. What we call the mind or consciousness is just a byproduct of material phenomena, just a byproduct of material physical processes. Somewhat like, I think they use the simile, it's just like if you mix rice water or grape water with yeast, it creates the property of intoxication. And so the intoxication is just the byproduct of the yeast and the grape juice. And so they say consciousness is just a byproduct of the interaction of the four elements, earth, water, heat, and air. And so when a person dies, the earth element in the body goes back to the earth, to the universal earth element. The water element of the body goes back to the universal water element, the heat of the body or the fire goes back to the universal fire or the cosmic heat, and the air of the body goes back to the air of the atmosphere. Then the sense faculties return to space. The idea is that the sense faculties come from space, and so they return to space. And so what is left of a person when a person dies? Just the corpse, nothing else. No consciousness going on to a new life. No accumulation of karma producing its fruit. But four men carry away the corpse on the bear. And then at the funeral, people will praise the dead person. Oh, he was such a good person. He did such lofty deeds. He had such a noble character. Until they cremate the body, then everybody forgets about him. And then his bones will whiten, and the burnt offerings will end with ashes. And then for that person who's died, everything has come to an end. And so this person says, giving is the teaching of fools. If anybody asserts that there is some kind of benefit from giving, charity, making offerings, that is just empty, useless prattle. According to his teaching, the fools and the wise people alike are cut off and annihilated with the death of the body, with the breakup of the body. And after death, they do not exist in any form, in any way. So this is a teaching of a very, very coarse type of materialism. In the Buddha's time, this teaching was held by, there was one well-known teacher who's sometimes mentioned in the text. His name was Ajita Kesala Kambala. A Kesa Kambala means a hair blanket. Apparently, as part of his ascetic practice, he wore a hair blanket around his body. There are seats, even a couple of rows up. If you... Okay. Okay, now, in today's world, there are many people who subscribe to a doctrine of, we call this philosophical materialism. They hold that a person just consists of the material factors, and then when the person breaks up, there's nothing that survives after death. But still, in the present-day world, it seems that a belief in philosophical materialism doesn't commit one necessarily to a kind of ethical nihilism. But in the Buddha's time, it was considered sort of standard that one would believe in some kind of survival after death. And so the dominant belief was that there is the survival of the soul after death, and that the soul in its next incarnation, in its future incarnations, will reap the results of karma. And so the Buddha upheld also the teaching of karma, even though he didn't accept the teaching of the individual soul. But the dominant view amongst the Brahmins was that the soul survives and reaps the result of its karma, one's karma. And so for somebody to come up and say that the person is just consists of material elements would be a very, very bold assertion going against the whole dominant stream of Indian thought during this period. And to further assert their position, they would deny the usefulness of any kind of ethical behavior. Okay, now in paragraph 8, we have the way Venerable Ananda devises a refutation of this position, or a rejoinder to this position. And Venerable Ananda doesn't put this in his own words, but he describes this as the way a wise person might reflect. And so first, the wise person considers that this good teacher holds such and such a doctrine and view as this, then it repeats the whole view. Then he says, if this good teacher's words are true, then both of us are exactly equal. We stand on the same level, because if his words are true, we're both going to be cut off and annihilated with the death of the body. And so I have not followed his teaching. I have not practiced his teaching. I have not lived the holy life as he teaches it. And yet I'm on the same level as he is, because even though he's living this spiritual life, but there's no point for him to live it, because we're both going to be annihilated at death. And so then he continues, it is superfluous or pointless for this good teacher to go about naked, to shave his head and his beard, to sit in the squatting posture, to pull out his hair and beard. You see, the teachers who held this position apparently, even though they didn't believe in any kind of survival after death, but to conform to the way of life expected of a samana, they would live a celibate life, they would shave off their hair and their beard, and they would wear rough clothing or sometimes go about naked. And so he's thinking, this wise person who's reflecting is thinking, this ascetic is living this very rough ascetic life, and I am living in my home with several children. I'm using Benares sandalwood as a scent. I wear garlands and use perfume and unguents. I accept gold and silver. And yet we're both going to have the same destination, the same future at death. So why should I live the spiritual life under this teacher? Why should I give up my quite comfortable life, household life, in order to follow this very rough and demanding ascetic life if we're both going to come to a complete end at death? And so if he makes an inquiry about this way of living the holy life, he'll see that this way of living the holy life is unreasonable. It even pulls out the very foundations of the holy life. And so he turns away from it and leaves it. Okay, so this is the first way that negates the living of the holy life. And this way, this teaching is called the Natikavada. That means the doctrine of denial or negation. The denial that there's any results of good or bad actions. Okay, now we come to the second way of, or second negation of the spiritual life in paragraph 10. Okay, here some teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. And this will be a rather terrifying type of view. When one acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow or makes others inflict sorrow, when one oppresses or makes others inflict oppression, when one intimidates or makes others inflict intimidation. I'll just abridge a little bit. No evil is done by the doer. When one kills living beings, takes what is not given, breaks into houses, plunders wealth, commits burglary, ambushes highways, seduces another's wife, utters falsehood. In other words, one can be breaking all of the basic precepts, but no evil is done by the doer. Then he continues, if one were to take a razor-rimmed wheel and to go around making the living beings on this earth into one mass of flesh. In other words, one cuts them down with that razor sharp wheel so that they're all dead, nothing left but heaps of dead flesh. Because of this, there would be no evil and no outcome, no result of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the river Ganges, killing and slaughtering, mutilating, torturing, because of this, there would be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges, giving gifts and encouraging others to make gifts, making offerings and so on, encouraging others to make offerings, because of this, there would be no merit and no outcome of merit. By giving, by training oneself, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is no merit and no outcome of merit. Okay, this view seems very similar to the first view, but there seems to be some difference between them. In this view, it seems that the teacher is not necessarily rejecting the occurrence of rebirth. He could be holding that there's some form of rebirth or reincarnation, but what the main point of his teaching is that there's no validity in making any kind of ethical or moral distinctions, that we have no reason for regarding certain actions as good and other actions as evil. And so these actions that we conventionally designate as good and as evil are just conventional designations on our part, but they don't produce a karmic result. It seems that even if this teacher accepts the occurrence of rebirth or reincarnation, he doesn't see rebirth to be governed by the working by our own actions, because he says that if one does deeds that are conventionally regarded as evil, there's no creation of evil karma and no outcome of the evil karma. And if one does deeds that are conventionally regarded as good, one doesn't create good karma and there's no outcome from those apparently good deeds. In other Buddhist texts, this view is called Akiryavada, which means the doctrine of not doing. It's the view that one doesn't do good by one's actions, one cannot do good and cannot do evil. In the Buddha's time, this view was held by a teacher named Purana Kassapa. And one thing I have to say about these views, at least most of them, we don't have any other source for knowing about these views except for the early Buddhist suttas. And so we can't always say for sure that the Buddhist suttas are representing these views correctly. Because first, the Buddhist community had received them probably by hearsay, not through direct contact with proponents of those views. And then the Buddhists are interpreting them according to their understanding. So it's possible that they misunderstood the views. We can't rule that out, because the only source that we have for knowing about just about all of these views are the Buddhist texts themselves. Because it sometimes seems to me rather strange that a teacher who holds views like this could get any following at all. One would think the only safe thing a king of the period could do with him is to lock him away in prison. Otherwise, he'll be a danger to the realm. Okay, so then Ananda presents the process of reflection in the same way. Again, he thinks that a teacher like this holds such a view as this. And if this teacher's words are true, then we're both on the same level. That there's no distinction between good and bad. And so one could think, I can do deeds which are everybody considers to be very bad, and this teacher could do deeds that everybody considers to be very good. But we can't judge on the basis of this teacher's premises. It would not be legitimate to say he is doing good and I'm doing bad. And so apparently this teacher is trying to lead a good life by renouncing the world, shaving off his hair and beard, leading a very simple, austere, renunciate life. And yet, on the premises of that teacher's teaching, we're both on the same level. And so there's no point in following the spiritual life according to that teacher, since it won't lead to any kind of fruit, any kind of benefit. Okay, so this is the second negation of the spiritual life that the Buddha rejects. Okay, then we come to the third teaching. This is in paragraph 13. This is called the doctrine of non-causality. So this teacher holds this doctrine. There is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. And there is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause or condition. And so this teacher is affirming that there is defilement and purification, but he's saying that there's no cause for beings to become defiled and purified. This is a teaching, as we'll see, of a kind of fatalism, that everything is controlled by fate or destiny. So this teacher goes on to say there is no power, no energy, no manly strength, no manly endurance or fortitude. In other words, we have no power or energy of our own to create our own actions. All beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power, and energy. They are molded by destiny, circumstance, and nature, and they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. According to this teacher, there were six classes of human beings into which the souls are reborn, or maybe six classes of living beings into which the souls are reborn. But according to this teacher, the entire process of reincarnation is governed by destiny, circumstance, and nature. They use the key term for this doctrine is niyati. And the yati is what is translated as destiny. So according to this teaching, all beings are determined by destiny. Every being has its own destiny, and through their destiny, they have to go on through the cycle of rebirths, moving from one realm to another, until finally, again, without any effort on their part, they gain liberation just by going from realm to realm. Eventually, through the working of destiny, every soul gains liberation, but it doesn't depend on our own effort, our own actions. And so again, the wise person reflects on this teacher's teaching and sees that if everything is determined by destiny, then what would be the point in my living the holy life? Really, I can't make any choice. If I'm if I'm living the household life, that is my destiny. If he is living a life of renunciation, that's his destiny. And so there's no reason for me to try to go against my destiny of being a householder and make a choice to live a life of renunciation. And so we're both on the same footing because of that. And so reflecting in this way, he'll reject this spiritual life, or he'll reject that way of living, which is a negation of the spiritual life. Okay, then we come to the, and in the Buddha's time, this view, it's also called Ahetukavada, which means the doctrine of non-causality. In other words, there's no cause for beings to be defiled and purified. It all occurs through the working of destiny. And in the Buddha's time, this view was held and expounded by a teacher named Makkali Gosala. Okay, then we come to the fourth view, which is a negation of the spiritual life. This is on paragraph 16. This is a teacher who holds that there, he uses the expression, there are these seven bodies, but there are actually seven entities that are said to be unmade, uncreated, without a creator, barren, standing firmly like mountain peaks, standing like pillars. These similes bring out, or intended to bring out, the fact that these seven entities are eternal and everlasting. They do not move, they do not change, they do not obstruct one another. And none is able to cause pleasure, pain, or pleasure and pain in another. So what are these seven entities? There's the earth body, water body, fire body, air body. Those are the four material elements. Then there is pleasure and pain, the two types of feeling. And then the seventh is the soul. So those are the seven bodies. And now comes the strange part of this teacher's teaching. Again, it's a bit terrifying. He says, there is no killer, no slaughterer, no hearer, no speaker, no cognizer, no intimator, no one who communicates anything. Even if one cuts off somebody's head with a sharp sword, one doesn't deprive anyone of life. All one is doing is affecting the arrangement of the material elements. And the soul is eternal, so the soul can't be killed. And so nobody loses their life. And so if one cuts off somebody's head with a sharp sword, the sword merely passes through the space between the seven bodies. So don't go out and cut off somebody's head. And then if you get dragged into court, you say, I didn't kill anyone. My sword just went through the space between the seven bodies. Okay, then there comes here a rather long and complicated cosmology that goes on. I'm not going to read all of this. You can read it yourself, but at the very end comes the statement, pleasure and pain are meted out. The round of rebirths is limited. There is no shortening or extending it, no increasing or decreasing it. Just as a ball of string, when thrown, goes as far as the string unwinds, so too, by running and wandering through the round of rebirths, fools and the wise both will make an end of suffering. Now there's a difference between the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya. They both present these four views. But in the version in the Digha Nikaya, in the Samanyapala Sutta, Sutta number 2 of the Digha Nikaya, this long cosmology, starting from the sentence, there are these 1,400,000 principal kinds of generation, and so on, down to the end, the statement that the fools and wise both will make an end of suffering. That statement is attached not to the view about the seven bodies, but to the third view, the view of predestination or fatalism, that there's no cause for the defilement and purification of beings. And it seems to me that the version in the Digha Nikaya seems better, more sensible, because the idea that the fools and the wise go through the round of rebirths and both make an end of suffering, that seems to tie up better with the idea that all beings are molded by destiny, circumstance, and nature. So just bear in mind that there are differences between the way the Digha Nikaya reciters preserve the four views and the way the Majjhima Nikaya reciter preserved the four views. Okay, again, the wise man reflects on the faults in this position, that if this view is true, that there's no point in anybody leading a life of renunciation, since even in leading the household life, surrounded by my wife and children and all the enjoyments, we both will have the same destiny. And so a wise person examines this view and rejects it as being pointless. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there are any questions about any of these views.
Just on the last one, please. I shall make unripened action ripen or annihilate ripened action as it comes. We're still in paragraph 16 down towards the bottom. There is none of this.
Okay, there is none of this, yeah. By this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall make unripened action ripen or annihilate ripened action as it comes. It seems to me that the view that's being negated here is a view of the Jains. The view that by undertaking a certain observance or a certain type of asceticism or holy life, one makes unripened action ripen and one annihilates ripened action as it comes. The word action here is karma. So it seems to have been a Jain belief, though not accepted by the Buddhists, that by undertaking certain types of practice, especially ascetic practice, one causes unripened karma to mature, to ripen. And then when that karma ripens, then one annihilates it through that ascetic practice. Okay. According to the Jains, in order to gain liberation, one has to annihilate all of the karma that one has accumulated from the past. And so the Jains undertake the ascetic practices as a way of wearing away their old karma. Yes, please.
Just to be clear, so you're saying that with that sentence, he's saying that those who hold this view number 4 deny that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way I understand it. Because this view that by this virtue, that sila, in other words, by this moral observance, or by this observance, the word here is vata, usually signifies some kind of ascetic practice or asceticism. Again, that's some kind of self-mortification or spiritual life. I shall make unripened karma ripen. It's the ascetic practice that makes the karma mature. And then when the karma matures, then one annihilates it as it comes up. That is not really a principle of Buddhist practice. Through Buddhist practice, what one does is to eliminate the defilements which underlie karma. And it's the according to the Buddha's teaching, it's the defilements that keep the cycle of birth and death moving on. And so, according to the Buddha, one can't actually eliminate all karma from the past, because that karma is boundless in quantity. But what gives the opportunity for karma to ripen is the defilements that bring about rebirth in samsara. And so when one eliminates the defilements, then as long as one continues to live, past karma will still have the opportunity to ripen. But once one is completely liberated from the cycle of rebirth, then there's no longer an opportunity for karma to ripen. Any further questions?
Well, just continuing with the fourth cause. So basically the opposing view, I guess what Anand is saying is the correct view is that if you just wait it out, as opposed to forcing it to come, you can just wait it out and the end will be the same.
That is not Ananda's position.
Right, but that's the alternate to the Jainism view. But here's this ascetic and he's forcing karma to ripen.
Yeah.
As opposed to not being an ascetic and the same karma will ripen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because in the view of this teacher, as he continues, he says the round of rebirths, that is actually the word there is samsara, is limited. There is no shortening or extending it. Actually, this view seems to go better with the doctrine of destination or fatalism,
mm-hmm.
that everybody has their own fixed limit to samsara, and so there's nothing that one can do to shorten it by undertaking spiritual practices, by meditation, by developing insight. And even if one lives a very lax, self-indulgent life, one will not be increasing the length of one's existence in samsara. When the time is up, then one gets liberated. Just as when one throws the ball of string, it rolls and rolls till it reaches the end of the string, and then it stops rolling. So the rolling of the ball of string is determined by the length of the piece of string.
Can you add to that list the name of this?
I should add number four. There's not such a neat name for this type of view. Sometimes it's just called the view of the seven bodies.
I didn't get these until the fourth one.
Okay, it's called, I just use the English translation since there's not really a fixed expression for it in Pali. So I just call it the view of the seven bodies. And the contemporary of the Buddha who held this view, his name was Pakuda Kachayana. Yes, Anthony.
Is it a form of nihilist atomism?
It's seems to be a form of atomism. The way it's presented here, I wouldn't call it nihilism in the sense of the first view, which is the view that beings come to a complete end at death, because the proponent of this view regards the soul as eternal. But it seems, according to the way the view is presented here, the soul has its fixed destiny, and so no matter what it does, it won't affect its destiny from life to life, but it has its fixed duration within samsara, and when that duration is up, then it's released. Yeah.
I'm wondering if, would you say, just a guess, that the difference between number three and number four might be that number three, the view seems to be that there's nothing you can do about your karma.
Yeah.
Would you say in this number four that, it would go as far as saying that there isn't even karma?
That there isn't even karma? They actually, the way it's presented here, if you look at that complicated cosmology, he has different kinds of karma. He says there are 500 kinds of action, that's karma, and five kinds of karma, and three kinds of karma, and even one kind of karma and half a kind of karma. We don't really know the actual intention of these statements, but he's affirming that there is some kind of karma. But what he's intending, this we don't know.
It's just preset and then you fall into one of these multiple categories.
You fall into... Maybe that is the way, maybe it's preset, yeah. Yeah, it could be. And it could also be the case that these views, that this cosmology isn't correctly connected to this view, but that it should go with view number three. Even the companies of monks who were charged with transmitting the text seem to have mixed up the views. So the part got attached to one view, part to, in one company attached it to one view, the other company to another view. Okay, one thing I should point out about these four views, there's a special term for them in the Buddhist texts that I wrote here. They're all called niyata micha ditti, which means that they are fixed wrong views. And the idea is that if one holds these views strongly and decides on them definitely and tries to propagate them, it creates a type of strong, unwholesome karma that will block off the possibility of achieving a higher rebirth in the heavenly world or achieving liberation.
And what's this translation again? Just
That niyata micha ditti, or a fixed wrong view, or wrong view with a fixed result. Because all of these views, what's common to all of these views is that if one draws out their consequences or their implications, they undermine the basis for ethics, for ethical behavior. Yes.
What would the Buddha do today if he encountered an ethical materialist?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. But now I think maybe I misunderstood the question. The way I understood it, what would the Buddha say to an ethical materialist today? Because there are, as I said, people who are philosophically materialists who might still hold high standards of ethics. For example, somebody like Richard Dawkins, I don't know his personal behavior, but he's philosophically materialist, that we're just the products of our genes. All there is just a material process of, you know, biological birth determined by the genes. And there's no kind of survival of any kind of soul or mind or consciousness beyond death. And yet, for all I know, he might probably has rather high ethical standards as far as acting compassionately towards others, helping those in need, being generous.
And that view of ethics being based on the idea that ethics is a natural evolutionary component.
Yeah.
It's something that evolves with society.
Yeah.
And like the Buddha comes and says, here's rebirth, here's this idea of these other worlds.
Yeah. I think today the Buddha would approve of the ethical contact, the Buddha would approve of the ethical content in ethical materialism, but he would criticize the idea that the life of a being comes to an end at the death of the body and say that there is some kind of continuation beyond death.
Any evidence that he could bring to bear?
Well, the Buddha would say, based on my recollection, you say,
it does require faith in the end, a great deal of faith.
If it comes from a spiritual teacher, it does. But there have been attempts to provide some kind of empirical evidence for rebirth. Probably the most solid type of empirical evidence is that of the cases collected and investigated by people like the late Professor Ian Stevenson, who was at the University of Virginia Medical School. He investigated many cases of children who apparently had claimed to have a recollection of their identity in a previous life, and they were able to identify their parents, their siblings, their house, the circumstances of their death. And Professor Stevenson had investigated a number of these cases and then have collected them into several volumes, several books. Okay, any further questions? You could ask it if it's too general or.
It came out of the Digha Nikaya.
Yeah.
Number 22, the Maha Satipatthana.
Yeah.
The great frames of reference. And it has to do with the definition of stress. And I have it here to read to you.
Okay.
The monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the Four Noble Truths. How does he remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the Four Noble Truths? There is the case where he discerns, as it has come to be, that this is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is cessation of stress. This is the way leading to the cessation of stress.
Hmm.
And what is the definition of stress?
Yeah.
That sounds like a ton of sorrow. He uses stress for dukkha.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is what is the Pali word there is dukkha, which is normally translated as suffering.
Right. No, it is a ton of sorrow.
Yeah. So this is actually, it's just the formulation of the Four Noble Truths.
That's what I thought out of it. I didn't understand why it was so segregated.
What do you mean segregated?
Well, why it was translated as stress as opposed to suffering or just dukkha in general. And I didn't know if there was some kind of subtlety in the translation.
I think that's his own choice of stress. I don't know why he would use that rather than suffering.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's acceptable.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure of that.
Mm. Yeah, but it's the Pali word which is commonly rendered as suffering.
Okay,
we'll end the sutta here and then I'll continue with the rest of the sutta next Tuesday. That's January 12th. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the deities, the dragon spirits, the nagas, the buddhas, and all other beings, wishing they be well, happy, and protect the Buddha's teaching and protect the world. Turn up the loudspeaker. Akasata Chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Desanam. Akasata Chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Mangparam. Etavata Chamhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhutanumodan Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya.